TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Terrorism and Globalization. Michael Parenti is one of the country's most prolific political thinkers and a highly popular public speaker. He authored 15 books on topics such as history, fascism, U.S. imperialism, globalism, and terrorism. He received his Ph.D. in political science from Yale in 1962. After a teaching career, he now lives in California and is a full-time writer and lecturer. You are about to hear excerpts from one of his most cherished recent speeches, his 2002 Santa Cruz talk on terrorism and globalization. He raises and answers questions such as, is the U.S. an imperial nation? Is capitalism good for the world? How does U.S. colonialism differ from that of Great Britain? And ultimately, who are the real terrorists? Here is Michael Parenti receiving a rousing welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I have a Ph.D. in political science, and it occurred to me that I never studied imperialism in all those years from grade school on. Oh, I heard about British imperialism and the Roman Empire and Soviet imperialism, which was going to take over the world, but U.S. imperialism, the term would horrify some of our fellow citizens who apparently trust everything their leaders say. I'm not one of those people who thinks that U.S. foreign policy is all mixed up, that it's all confused. Imperialism is really the real harsher word for what is now called globalization. And what it really is the expansionist form of capitalism, of giant corporate capitalism. You got to make that clear. We're talking about the giant corporations. Because when I launch into criticisms about capitalism, I immediately get people, there are always people sloshing in bathos and start talking about, what about the mom and pop business, and they struggle and they build it up and they create some jobs from some other people. Ooh. And I go, ooh, nice. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about these giant multi-billion dollar corporations that are not adding a little something to the community, but carving up whole continents and destroying our ecology. That's what we're talking about. Can we talk about that? Giant corporate capitalism. So that's what I mean whenever I say capitalism, not mom and pop and small businesses, nice little bookstores, which I want to support too. Now, we are taught a few things about capitalism. We're taught that it's a system that works, and we're taught that it's brought us prosperity, that capitalism creates prosperity. I am going to argue against that hypothesis tonight. One. Two, I'm going to convince you that that hypothesis is wrong. Three, I'm going to do that in the next 5 or 10 seconds. Almost the entire world is capitalist, and almost the entire world is poor. There you are. I'm coming to this other thing that I'm using that the media usually doesn't use. It's called evidence. Look at the world. Most of the world is capitalist. There's capitalist Indonesia. It's miserably poor and getting poorer. There's capitalist India. There's capitalist Thailand. Capitalist Nigeria, El Salvador, Haiti, Mexico, Brazil, capitalist Argentina, which is falling apart and unraveling, capitalist Russia, Poland, Bulgaria, privatization, third worldization. Poor, poor. The number of people living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. That is capitalism's expansion. That's capitalism's prosperity that it's bringing. capitalism does not work quite well for the people in those countries. Now, that is also capitalism at its most successful. Because capitalism in Indonesia works quite well for the capitalists. It's just the people aren't doing too well. Well, okay, gee, I hadn't thought of it. And we never think of those countries as being capitalists, too. All right, doesn't work so well for the common people of those third world countries, but it's given us a good standard of living. Well, that, too, I'm going to refute. It's going to take maybe a little longer than 5 seconds, maybe 20, 25 seconds. In this country, let's put aside the mass inequalities. Let's put aside the tens of millions of people who struggle from hand to mouth. Let's put aside the many who live without real economic security, which might include many of us. Let's put aside the desperate ones at the very bottom. Let's even put aside the middle-class people who are getting ripped off left and right with their taxes and overwork and loss of benefits and the like. Let's put aside the impoverishment of the public sector and the destruction of a livable environment. Let's accept the idea that we live in great material abundance, which, in fact, compared to much of the world, we do. Many in this country do live well. But it wasn't capitalism that gave us this standard of living. It was the democratic struggle against capitalism. They didn't give us all these things. I mean, why don't we Americans work for 15 cents an hour as they do in Haiti, in Indonesia? Is it because we're just so much more self-respecting? Is that it? No. It's because the democratic class struggle has advanced to a more favorable level. And that's happened only in the last few generations. In 1900, America was a third world country, half a century before the term was invented. We were a third world nation. Child labor was widespread. Poverty was widespread, 14-hour workdays, 10-year-olds working in factories for 14 hours, 7 days a week, no social services to speak of, a few church soup kitchens and charities maybe, no social benefits, typhoid epidemics in our major cities, tuberculosis and other diseases of poverty, no public housing or public health programs, very little public education, no public libraries really. Advances came not with capitalism. That's what the country was, a pure, free market, unregulated, undiluted capitalism in 1900, but massive margins of profit, huge margins of profit, massive, massive, massive wealth for the Mellons and the Morgans and the Huntingtons and the Hartfords and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts. More money than they knew what to do with. And you know what they wanted after they got that money? They wanted more, and they wanted more, and they would destroy whole communities to get more and more and more. Wealth, my friends, wealth is the most damaging and the most dangerous addiction that this society faces. It was the people, it was the American people, it was the working people in this country who fought and fought for the eight-hour day, who fought for public education, who fought for public health services. It was the people who fought for decent housing and a decent standard of living, who fought for a minimum wage, who fought against discrimination. Name one great leader, name one great political leader, name one great great intellectual who fought and did those things. No, those people, they jumped on the bandwagon after the people fought. And it was the plutocrats, it was the capitalists, it was the economic royalists who fought against every one of those things. They fought against giving you a decent wage. They're still fighting against that. They're still fighting for wage cuts. They fought against Social Security. They fought against occupational safety. They're still fighting against it. They fought against environmental protections. They still are fighting against it, undermining it every way they can, because they're afraid they're going to lose out on a dollar. Because every dollar they've got to give to you, every dollar they've got to spend on stupid things like public safety and wages and occupational safety and consumer product safety. Every dollar wasted on stupid things like that, which the free market would take care of, every dollar spent on that is one less dollar for their insatiable greed. And that's it. So don't credit the capitalists for giving you whatever modicum of prosperity you have. We got it despite it. We tore it out of their teeth and out of their greedy claws. And we still got to hold on to it, and they're trying to get it back from us. It wasn't capitalism that brought these advances. It was democracy. It was the people in action. It was class struggle. Class struggle, my friends, is one of the major and central expressions of democracy. That's what class struggle is about. When they get up, you know, they do class warfare on us all the time. Taxes, tax cuts for the rich, this, that. They're always doing class war on us. The minute we rally and we start attacking this corporate rich, they say, oh, you're preaching class warfare. George Bush, George the First used to say that. The minute we start to fight back or answer back, oh, you're preaching class warfare. I have another name for that. It is class struggle. It is class warfare. The other name for it, when people become the active social agents of their own lives and go out and protest and try to better their lives, that another name for that is called democracy. And they wouldn't recognize it if you slap them right in the face with it. They wouldn't know what it is. And it was these economic royalists, the rich bankers, the merchant class, the slaveholders, they fought against political democracy as well as economic democracy. They fought against the elimination of property qualifications for voters and office holders. After all, they put that into the laws. They put that into the laws, those property qualifications. Those were their laws. They fought against extending the vote, universal suffrage for working men in the 1820s and 30s. They fought against suffrage for women. They fought against the abolition of slavery and Jim Crow. They fought against honest elections and democratic ballot access and proportional representation and campaign finance reform and securing civil liberties. And they're still fighting against it. Do you have the evidence? Have I proven my case? Just go out and look at it all. That's what they're doing. Political and economic democracy are the things that they fear the most. Democracy is always under siege and always endangered by plutocracy. So when we say that capitalism works or it doesn't work, we must specify for whom. Because capitalism doesn't work all that well. Giant corporate finance capital doesn't work all that well for third world nations. It doesn't work all that well for other people. But it works quite well for the capitalists. The rate of capital accumulation per dollar invested is much higher in third world countries. The public sector is smaller or non-existent. Regulation is less, non-existent in many cases. The goal is to get us all back to the third world. The dream is to get all of North America and Denmark and Sweden and Western Europe and such, get it all back, get them all working as hard as the people do in Indonesia. Oh, who's going to buy all this stuff? Oh, you'll buy. You may have to buy less. You just have to work twice as hard to buy. Do you work twice as hard to buy that pair of shoes? I make that much more on those shoes. So they're working very hard to get us back to 1900. To achieve all this, the U.S. globalists have been the greatest purveyors of state-sponsored terrorism the world has ever seen. U.S. national security state has supported and financed Muslim terrorists in Afghanistan, in Bosnia and Kosovo, against a democratically and elected multi-party Yugoslavian government in Bosnia and Kosovo, in various other countries. U.S. operatives have worked with death squads, torturers, drug traffickers in countries too numerous to list here. All of this is a matter of public record. All of it is largely ignored by the corporate media. Very little of it is known by the general public. Since World War II, the U.S. national security state has been a key force in overthrowing popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Iran under Mossadegh, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries too numerous to mention. And replacing them with pro-capitalist military regimes that opened up their markets, their resources, their cheap labor to Western corporate investors on terms that were completely favorable to the investors. In those years, the U.S. has launched terrorist, state-sponsored terrorist attacks and proxy mercenary wars in Angola, 2 million dead, Mozambique, 900,000 killed, the Renamo murderers, CIA trained and financed. How many of us read large, copious, penetrating articles about these things? Did the media provide that for us? I don't think so. Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Zaire, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, and other countries. These lists are not exhaustive. I'm just giving you the names I jotted down from my own memory. In the last 3 decades, U.S. forces have launched aerial attacks or direct military actions with U.S. forces. Now we're talking about U.S. missiles, U.S. forces, not just U.S. weapons in the hands of mercenary or comprador groups, but U.S. forces directly. In violation of U.N. charter and international law, including invasions against Vietnam, Dominican Republic, North Korea, invasions or attacks, I'm saying, Laos, Cambodia, Haiti, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Yugoslavia. There's no rogue state. There's no communist state that has a record like that. In these last 3 decades, the number of countries invaded, bombed, large numbers of people killed and destroyed. When there's no evil Axis country that has this record of violent aggression, mass destruction, and violation of international law. Today, the U.S. neocolonial empire, and you understand the difference between imperialism and neo-imperialism, our empire, the British Empire, when I was a kid, you used to take a globe and you could see all this pink all over the globe. That was the British Empire. And you say, my gosh, where you went and you planted the Union Jack and all that. 50 years before the Brits thought of doing this in India, the U.S. had devised a new form of imperialism. And they did it in Cuba. In about 1902, they went to Cuba in 1904 and they said, look, we just stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, who were willing to negotiate a settlement and leave, but we didn't want them to leave. We wanted to have a war so we could have an excuse to take not only Cuba, but Puerto Rico and Guam and the Philippines. So we got you now, but it doesn't look so good. We're a republic having colonies. In fact, I never had colonies. Another thing, when I was a kid in school, they were called territories. The U.S. had territories, different places. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you Cubans your independence. We're going to give you your own constitution. In fact, here it is. And check the spelling because our Spanish isn't that good. And you're going to have your own presidente, and you're going to have your own currency, money, and you can put anybody you want on the dollar bills. You can put Jose Marti if you want. It doesn't have to be George Washington. Hey, we're flex. You're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue, but you have only one star on it because you're just a little island. And all we get in return, in our usual selfless way, is we will just own your sugar industry, your tobacco industry, your nickel mining, your oil refineries, and we'll control all your exports and imports, and we have control of all your relations with third nations. So you're independent now. There you go. They did that, you know, they did that half a century before the British thought of doing it. So we have these, all these independent countries whose militaries we support, whose markets we control, who we can bring to their knees with the threat of sanctions and the like. 300 major military bases all over the world. We need them, Dick Cheney says, we need them because there are other enemies. With the overthrow of communism, there was a sudden panic, an enemy shortage they had in Washington. What do we do? Because the only way the empire can exist, the empire exists by feeding off the republic. It uses the resources of the republic so that patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. They need your taxes, they need your resources, they need your sons and daughters so that they can go and do these things. And to do that, the only way they can do that is by convincing you this is for your interest, your security, your safety, because of the world out there of terrible threats and such. U.S. leaders have been destroying democratic movements throughout the Middle East, in Syria, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Iran, and Iraq. Democratic popular movements in Turkey, country after country, one country after another, those democratic movements have been repressed. The only channel they've got left is this Islamic, ultra-nationalist, right-wing expression. And that's the route they take. And so then, we American citizens, we become the targets of their terrorism, as happened a year ago, September 11. Now that September 11, which many of us looked at and saw it as a horrible event, the people who are running this country now looked at that as a golden opportunity. That's not my speculation. On September 14, I heard President-elect George Bush say, this may prove to be an opportunity, a really important opportunity. Remember those wonderful things he was saying? It's going to be the first war of the 21st century. The first war, yay! Instead of saying this should be a century of no war, or this should be the last war, or let's try to avoid war in this new century, saying this is going to be the first war and something to look forward to, all those other wars. And this has defined my administration now. He saw the peg, he saw this opening. Now, the goal of all this imperialism is a very consistent and very rational goal. The countries, the movements, the leaders that are acted against are those who try to develop things in a different way. The countries, the movements, and the leaders who get U.S. support are those who foster the interests of the Fortune 500. The basic struggle is between those who think that the land, the labor, the resources, the natural resources, and the markets of the world should be there for the benefit of capital accumulation, for the benefit of a few, as against those who think that the land, the labor, and the natural resources and the capital of the world should be there for the development of human communities and human needs. That is the basic struggle that's going on here. The goal now, with the overthrow of communism, the goal now is to prevent also competing centers of capitalist development. The goal now is to really stick it to the working classes of all these countries that have won all these democratic gains, many of which the plutocrats have had to give them out of fear of communism, to sell it to them, to say, you know, see, you've got so much better life than the people over there in those countries do. You're so much better off. And all. Now we don't have to say that anymore. Say, look what's happening in Russia. People have been reduced to beggary. Human services have been pretty much abolished. All the public-owned industries are being privatized and all that. Why should we have to tolerate any of that stuff here? Now we're going to stick it to the working class. You people are going to work harder and harder. We're going to get you back to 1900. That is their goal. And the goal against third world nations was much the same. Often aid was given to third world nations, an attempt to develop a middle class in these nations, stability, to make sure some level of prosperity, some little visibility points of prosperity so that these countries, what? Would not go communist. Now they got nowhere else to go. Those programs are being dropped. There is opposition, though, and the goal is to build up these coalitions, build a base of opinion, do these two things. One, you organize horizontally, and also you impact and organize vertically. You take that base, that it's not one two-step, those two are going on simultaneously, and you target our leaders. You target those oil leaders. You target them and you pressure them and you let them know that the people here don't tolerate this kind of regression. They don't think they're not interested in your opinions. Oh, my friends, they're so interested. They follow, they listen, they bring people. I don't know who he is. I don't want to point him out. And maybe that clean-cut guy there, I don't know. But they track, they listen, they tap our phones, they do all these things. They are so keenly worried. They know that they stand on our shoulders, and if we begin to move and rumble and really get it together, they begin to really sway and shake up there. Remember, brothers and sisters, when the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you very much.
You heard highlights of Michael Parenti's September 2002 Santa Cruz talk on terrorism and globalization. Parenti is one of the country's most prolific political thinkers. His most recent books are Against Empire, The Terrorism Trap, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. His writings are translated into over 12 languages. You can contact Michael Parenti via his website www.michaelparenti.org. That's michaelparenti.org. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Michael Parenti and a listing of archival speeches on TUC Radio's website www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a 70-minute unedited copy of the complete talk by Michael Parenti on terrorism and globalization by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
Now, why is the U.S. national security state involved in acts of destabilization, sabotage, propaganda, terror, drug trafficking, torture, and death squads in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and Europe? Why is it now suddenly so impelled by humanitarian concerns for the Albanians in Kosovo? Is that why we're in Yugoslavia? Is it humanitarian compassion that compels U.S. forces to be bombing, to have bombed four countries in the last 6 months? Is it humanitarian concern that the U.S. is involved in proxy wars in Angola, Colombia, and various other countries? If it's oppressed minorities U.S. leaders are worried about, why doesn't Clinton bomb the Turkish people for what their leaders have been doing to the Kurds? I mean, it would be crazy and irrational to bomb people in Turkey, to bomb the ordinary people because of what they're doing. But that's what we're doing. That's what is happening in Yugoslavia. Why don't we bomb the Indonesians for killing over 200, because their generals killed over 200,000 East Timorese? What about bombing Israel for what it's done to the Palestinians? What about bombing the Czech Republic for the way it has mistreated the Romani, or called gypsies here in our country? What about bombing the Guatemalan people? Let's go bomb Guatemala City for the systematic slaughter of tens of thousands of Mayan villagers all over Guatemala. In fact, the U.S. wouldn't ever think of bombing them. The U.S., in most of those cases, Turkey, Indonesia, Guatemala, gave them aid, gave them guns, gave them training. It's totally complicit with those horrible atrocities. Why doesn't he bomb Great Britain for oppressing the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland? And while Clinton is at it, why doesn't he bomb himself for the treatment of Native American Indians, African Americans, and working people in general? In 1919, a noted conservative economist, Joseph Schumpeter, whose work I've read extensively, incidentally, Schumpeter wrote this about ancient Rome. That policy which pretends to aspire to peace, but unerringly generates war. The policy of continual preparation for war. The policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall on the Roman people. Does that sound familiar to you at all? We hear today that we don't have one enemy. We have many now. The world communism has been defeated, but now we have many different enemies. They're all around, ready to pounce on us. And unless we keep those extortionary military budgets going, unless we keep being everywhere, all the place, our people will not be safe. They're out there ready to pounce upon us. Luxembourg. Wouldn't they want to pounce on Luxembourg? Why do they want to pounce on us? Well, I maintain that that's just the mass line to cover the class line. Yugoslavia, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, was built on an idea, as Ramsey Clark said. Very few countries are actually built on an idea. The idea was that the southern Slavs would not remain weak, divided people falling out among themselves or falling prey to some imperialist outsider. That they would join together and they would have a territory that was large enough and strong enough to become a viable nation with its own development. And sure enough, after World War II, multi-ethnic socialist Yugoslavia was a post-war industrial power, a viable nation, and an economic success. Between 1960 and 1980, it had one of the most vigorous growth rates, a decent standard of living, free medical care and education, guaranteed right to a job, 1 month free vacation with pay. Oh, when was the last time I had a month vacation? Affordable public transportation, housing, and utilities. Literacy rate over 90%. Life expectancy was 72 years. Most of the economy was in the public, not-for-profit sector. Now, such a country is a kind that global capitalism normally would not tolerate. Still, Yugoslavia was allowed to exist for some 45 years because it was seen as a buffer to the Soviet bloc, the Warsaw Pact nations. At the same time, efforts were made to undermine the socialistic features of Yugoslavia's economy. Yugoslavia opened itself up to Western capital penetration as early as the late 60s, early 70s, I think it was. I think they made the same mistake that the Polish Communist Party leaders made. They said, well, what we're going to do is continual basic industry, building up the industrial base, heavy industry, and we're also going to increase and improve consumer production. Now, how are we ever going to be able to do both of those things, you see? Very simply, we got the answer. We'll borrow from the West. Well, once they started borrowing, with borrowing from the West came IMF penetration and an enormous debt. With debt came IMF demands for restructuring. Restructuring is a euphemism for a harsh austerity program. You cut back in public sector spending. You cut wages. You cut employment. You abolish worker management enterprises. In other words, you force your people to work harder for less, producing more, consuming less, and with that difference, you pay off your debt schedule, or at least the interest that's accumulating on this wealth. Still, much of the economy was public sector and not for profit, including the very rich reserves of minerals and other natural resources in the province of Kosovo and elsewhere. Then came another blow. What I'm saying to you is that there was a conscious and deliberate plan to fragment and break up Yugoslavia. The other blow was in November of 1990, when President George Bush went to the U.S. Congress and pressured them to pass the Foreign Appropriations Law that called for the cutting off of all aid and credits to Yugoslavia. Trading without credits can be a disaster, especially for a country that doesn't have a hard currency, and this had a devastating effect on the country. The law also demanded that if any republic in Yugoslavia wanted further U.S. aid, it would have to break away from Yugoslavia and declare its independence. Okay? It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not my speculation. It's not my analysis. It's a public law. It's a public law. November 1990, the 1991 Foreign Appropriations Act. It's written right there. Go look at it. It required the U.S. State Department approval of election procedures and results in every one of the republics. It required that the republics do not hold national elections, but hold elections only in their own republics, and that the aid would go to individually to those republics. And when the aid did go, it went to those groups which the U.S. defined as democratic groups, which meant small right-wing ultra-nationalist and even fascistic parties. The ultimate goal was to break up Yugoslavia into a weak and helpless cluster of right-wing banana republics, privatized, deindustrialized. The U.S. decided to destroy, with the other Western powers, decided to destroy Yugoslavia in 1989 when it became evident that it was the one country in Eastern Europe that would not voluntarily overthrow what remained of its socialist system. It was the one country that was still trying for some kind of economic independence outside of the world global free market third worldization process. They wanted a Yugoslavia whose rich natural resources would be at the disposal of multinational corporations, whose populations would work at subsistence wages, whose economy offered no competition with existing capitalist producers, only new investment opportunities. They wanted a Yugoslavia whose petroleum, engineering, mining, and automotive industries would be undone and deindustrialized. And they wanted to abolish Yugoslavia's public sector services and social programs. Now, why would U.S. policymakers, you really think U.S. policymakers are motivated by some need to abolish the social programs, the public sector services, and Yugoslavia? Why would they want to do that? Do you think they are such nefarious, evil-intended individuals, they would want to abolish their social programs? Come on, Parenti. Are you being paranoid? Well, why would they want to abolish our social programs? As they have been doing? aid to families with dependent children, privatizing Social Security. That's what that president in Washington is doing. At least a third of it, he's going to chunk it off and privatize it. Right under your noses while saying he's saving and serving Social Security, public health services, public education, environmental regulation, as inadequate at all as all of these things have been, being cut back, cut back, cut back, library services, oh, we used to have that service, sorry, we don't have enough funds anymore. Not enough funds, you guys got to build those missiles, you see. It's the third worldization of Yugoslavia, and it's the third worldization of the USA, and it's the third worldizations of everywhere. They want a nation that's run by about 50 multi-billionaires, and the rest of us will be 260 million peasants working from hand to mouth for them. Another goal behind the dismemberment of Yugoslavia is to achieve ideological monopoly. Last year, in Serbian Bosnia, the last remaining radio station was a Serbian station. It was a dissident station. It was critical of NATO, critical of Western policy. It was the last station in all of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And the article in the New York Times, to see the reporter committing these mental gymnastics to explain why the NATO peacekeepers, i.e. Gestapo troops, went in and closed the station down, why that was a step toward more pluralistic democracy. That this was it was a marvelous thing to watch him do these gyrations, you know, down this column. Yugoslavia, before the NATO bombings, before this war began, before that, in Yugoslavia, every opposition newspaper, every opposition political party had its own newspaper, its own radio station, and there were over 20 of them. Milosevic today has more opposition parties in his parliament than any other leader in Europe. Of course, since the NATO bombings, they've shut down all the newspapers, they've shut down their radio stations, as we had happened in this country with German stations and things like that in World War I, if you remember, and we weren't even being bombed or attacked. Milosevic has been elected president three times, twice of the Republic of Serbia, once of the Yugoslav Republic, or what's left of it now, in elections which foreign observers said were pretty much okay and legitimate. Yet he is called a dictator. He is called a war criminal. The Hague War Crimes Tribunal has asked the United States for documentation of the war crimes that he has committed so that they may indict him as a war criminal. So far, it's been over a year. No documentation has been forthcoming. Will you please tell me, Noam Chomsky called him the monstrous Milosevic, giving no specifics. Could someone start giving me some specifics about it? Yugoslavia has another problem on this ideological monopoly. Its TV station is state-owned and is run by people who do not see the world the way the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Security State does. The Yugoslav TV journalist Novenka Jovicic told me, if I pronounce her last name right, I remember, she told me when I met her in Greece, this was at a conference, she told me that she asked the U.S. ambassador, "What do you want from us?" This was last year before the bombings. And he said, "We want your television system. Give us that." The U.S. imperialists want an ideological monopoly of all the world's media. And they've got something close to that already. In 1992, another blow was delivered against what remained of Yugoslavia. International sanctions led by the U.S. A freeze was imposed on all trade with Yugoslavia. The results brought utter economic disaster, hyperinflation, mass unemployment up to 70%, malnourishment, the collapse of the healthcare system at great cost to the population. By the way, sanctions, as the sanctions in Iraq demonstrate so horribly, the civilian population does not suffer collateral damage or incidental spin-off from sanctions. The civilian population is the primary target of sanctions. That's who's being targeted. To justify this violent intervention to the U.S. public, there's been an unrelenting demonization of the Serbian people for the better part of a decade. Don't take my word for it. Listen to Charles Boyd, listen to his credentials, former deputy commander of the U.S. European Command. Listen to what he wrote in Foreign Affairs, the establishment journal, the establishment foreign policy journal in the U.S. In Foreign Affairs, September, October 94, Boyd says, the popular image of this war in Bosnia is one of unrelenting Serbian expansion. In fact, what the Croatians call the occupied territories is land which the Serbs have held for more than three centuries. Most of the same is true of Serb land in Bosnia. In short, the Serbs are trying to hold on to their own. The U.S. has punished one side in this war, and unfairly, Boyd says. It has supported the legitimacy of a leadership in the Bosnian Muslim government that has become increasingly ethnocentric in its makeup, single-party in its rule, and manipulative in its diplomacy. We say we want peace, but we have encouraged a deepening of the war. Why were the Serbs targeted for demonization? By the way, at first they weren't. The U.S. was sort of backing the Serbs, and they got a guy, they pulled a guy up who they decided would be their man in the breaking up of Yugoslavia. He was a banker, and he was a Serbian nationalist, and his commitment to communism was very, very fuzzy or vague. And he was the ideal guy, they thought, and they called him a charismatic personality. His name was Milosevic, and he was our guy. But when they discovered that instead of being a tool, he would be an obstacle, then, of course, he became demonized. The Serbs are the largest nationality, and they're the one most opposed to the breakup of the Federation. But what about all the atrocities they've committed? Well, atrocities and executions have been committed on all three sides. You know, it really was fascinating. Someone's got to do a media analysis of this. In 95, when Clinton was thinking of going in to Bosnia, the atrocity stories about the Serbs started piping up. I'll talk about some of them later in a minute. When he decided, as the 96 election started getting closer, when he decided it might be too messy and we shouldn't go in, the atrocity stories slowed down, and then the media started. There was a frame of about a month or a couple of months here, a frame where they started saying, the Serbs are not the only ones committing atrocities, and they started quoting Croatian and Muslim atrocities and this sort of thing. It was amazing. Then when he decided after 96 that he was going to go in again, then the Serb atrocity stories came up again. It's sort of like the gas flame on your stove, the way the media will follow policy. And there's no hidden mystery about it. There's no conspiracy about it. They wait to what's fed out to them. If the Pentagon or the U.S. or the White House says, this is terrible, they say, this is terrible. We've got to go do this. They've got to go do this. U.S. no concern. We've got to go do that. They are the stenographers of power, you see. They're not the watchdogs of democracy. They're the lapdogs of the national security state. Show me a war where there are no atrocities. You saw that movie, remember that movie Saving Private Ryan, which I thought could have been called Saving Private Ridiculous after the first 15 minutes, which was brilliant, but after that. But it shows right there in the Normandy beach, it shows American troops killing, executing German prisoners who had surrendered, who had dropped their arms and come up. They just shot them dead. There were forced executions on both, grudge killings. The airborne divisions in northern Europe, northwestern Europe, and the German division would start killing each other's prisoners back and forth. Those are war crimes. There was right there on the big screen, by the way. Should we bomb Hollywood, maybe? Do you really trust U.S. leaders and the corporate-owned U.S. news media? I said to a friend of mine, the Serbian news source on the internet said that cluster bombs are being used. He said, oh, you're trusting Serbian sources? I said, what sources are you trusting? You're trusting Bill Clinton sources? Oh, well, Bill Clinton wouldn't lie to us, would he? Bill Clinton lied to us. It turns out they are using cluster bombs. It turns out they are using depleted uranium. Our own government now says it. You trust their stories? You remember the 500 premature babies that the Iraqis supposedly ripped from incubators in Kuwait, laughingly throwing the babies down on the hospital floors, vivid, detailed descriptions, even names of some of the poor victims whose little premature baby was in there. It turned out the story was a total fabrication. 500 premature babies in incubators. It turns out in all of L.A. County, there's not more than 50 incubators. Half of them are not being used at any one time. Did Kuwait specialize in premature birth? Instead of saying, we should have been saying, wait a minute, what is this story about? What's going on here? It was repeated again and again. I don't know any war where rapes are not committed, which is not to dismiss such awful things as rapes. Two rapes is two rapes too many. But the San Francisco Chronicle had a headline. It said, rape is an official Serb policy, Kosovo refugees say. Oh, they know about official policy. And you read down two columns, and finally you get the OSCE official says the rapes have only numbered in the dozens. Very few dozens, as a matter of fact. That's not an official policy. Oh, if Bill Clinton is looking to stop very few dozens of rapes, well, that's a slow 2 months in Washington, D.C. He could start much closer to home. He could concentrate on Capitol Hill, as a matter of fact, or even closer. It's so touching to see our leaders finally concerned about rape. It is so, so touching. But it's so odd that they've got to look so far away to go fight this crime. There was the infamous Sarajevo market massacre. The Serbs were blamed for that, and that became the turning point. That's when NATO forces went in and attacked, and that's when you had the worst single act, let's say, so recently, of mass forced expulsion, and that was 600,000 Serbs between 1991-95, but especially in 95 from Krajina, 200,000 of them. The Bosnian Serb the Croatian Serb defenses were broken by NATO bombs and all that, and the Croatian army came through. 200,000 Serbs, those who could get away alive, left the country. It turns out that massacre in Sarajevo market, as the story was leaked out on French television, that the UN knew all along that it was Muslim extremists who had bombed the people in that marketplace, that the explosion did not come from an artillery shell, but from a planted bomb. David Owen, who worked as an international negotiator with Cyrus Vance, in his book, Balkan Odyssey, page 262, himself admits that the NATO powers knew all along it was a Muslim bomb and the Serbs did not commit that act. Kosovo, when the KLA took over, the casualties of a year fighting, which had been 800, both sides, counting both sides, including Serbian police, including Albanians who didn't want to go along with the KLA, and the KLA sources took it over, it jumped suddenly to 2,000. When we called the San Francisco Chronicle bureau chief, we said, how did it jump from 800 to 2,000 in one day? He said, we don't know. Some of our eyebrows went up too now. Okay, but it's 2,000. Let's take that number. 2,000 casualties in over a year of fighting. That's not genocide. That's a civil war. A limited one. And now, of course, we have a massive reaction. By the way, the fighting on the ground with KLA and the Serbs has been going on all through this bombing. And that's what the Serbs have been doing. They've been fighting in Kosovo against the KLA. And they have also been forcibly expelling now areas and villages and people, getting them out. No doubt with atrocities being committed, especially among the paramilitaries. Still, when you look at the pictures, you see Kosovo Albanian refugees coming out. A Republican congressman who was just there, quoted in USA Today, said they all look so well fed. They have Nike shoes, Nike clothes and stuff. How does that happen? They came out in their tractors, in their trucks, and in their cars. These people should not have been driven from their villages. Let me point out something about the ethnic cleansing. In 1945, the non-Albanian population of Kosovo was about 50%. Between 1945 and 1998, Albanians were coming across the border in substantial numbers. Serbs were being driven off their lands and off their farms. There were repeated requests by Serbians to Tito, who himself was a Croatian, and these went unheeded. The shift came by 1998-1999. The Albanian population in Kosovo was about 75%, although the media keeps reporting 90%. The other 25% was made up of about 250,000 Serbs, about 100,000 Romani, or we call gypsies, and the others being Turks, Macedonians, Montenegrins, and a variety of other peoples. We also see how the leader of the country is demonized when he is targeted by U.S. policy. Gaddafi of Libya, whose actual sin was to nationalize the oil industry in Libya and begin to take the earnings from it and spend it on things like reforestation and health and education and clinics. Gaddafi, a Hitlerite megalomaniac, a pathological liar. Libya is now the object of sanctions. Noriega of Panama, a swamp rat, one of the world's worst drug thieves and scums. That was Peter Jennings on ABC said that one. I'm quoting Dan Rathers, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw here. Saddam Hussein, the butcher of Baghdad, a madman, a beast, worse than Hitler. Do you remember George Bush? George Bush was saying that about him. Now we have Milosevic, described as a new Hitler by Bill Clinton, called him a new Hitler. Bill Clinton learns his lessons well. Listen to the New York Times. The New York Times did there's a couple of paragraphs of psychobiography they had on Milosevic. And I want to read it. The people who write for the New York Times are very brilliant. Ooh, they're so brilliant, the New York Times people. They must be because they think so themselves, you know. And so it must be true. So I want to read this brilliant passage from the New York Times. And they're from New York, don't forget. Hey. I'm from New York, but I'm really not brilliant. If I were, I'd be writing for the New York Times. Milosevic. As a youth, Mr. Milosevic was a pudgy loner. See, now, being a loner, in the American political lexicon, this is obvious evidence of psychopathology, and you're an assassin, obviously, you know. Lee Harvey Oswald was a loner. Timothy McVeigh, the kid who shot Ronald Reagan, was named Hinckley, I forget. A loner. They all call a loner. Oh, they were lonely. They all have friends and family, but they call a loner. It's a loner. It's a loner. But Milosevic, you know, was a very specially serious case because he was a pudgy loner. See, now, pudginess is un-American. I mean, I don't think so. I think pudginess isn't bad at all, but pudginess is un-American. Now, if Milosevic, though, if he was a lean loner, that would be bad, too. So, it's best not to be either pudgy or lean. And let me read this whole quote to you, take it from the top again. As a youth, Mr. Milosevic was a pudgy loner. That's two strikes, pudgy loner. Who shunned sports, strike three. And wrote poetry, strike four. Does anyone need any further proof that here was a psychotic killer nerd? The Times goes on. Today, Milosevic is often described in Serbian profiles as reclusive and moody. His country's being bombed into the ground, and he's moody. With few friends, yeah, a lot of them are dead. Though in public appearances and interviews, he can be as effusive and happy as a door-to-door salesman. Fascinating, isn't it fascinating? I mean, so we have an effusive, reclusive salesman type. Even the managing editor of Foreign Affairs, the most establishment of journals we have, the managing editor notes, quote, Milosevic, who rules an impoverished country that has not attacked its neighbors, is no Adolf Hitler. He is not even Saddam Hussein. And it's pretty bad when Foreign Affairs starts sounding good, you know? It really makes you realize where your own media, they're not our media, where their media really are at. Well, some people argue, look, it's not a case of class or international interventionist issues. It's nationalism, these ancient ethnic enmities. That's what it really is all about. Well, that presumes that class and ethnicity are mutually exclusive and competitive forces. It's got to be either one or the other. Not at all. Ethnic enmity can be enlisted to serve class interests. The CIA tried to do that with the Hmong people in Vietnam, to divide, with the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua and elsewhere. The CIA did that in Bosnia. Don't take my word for it that the CIA was in Bosnia. Check the headlines. Manchester, London Guardian, November 1794. CIA agents training Bosnian army. The London Observer, November 20. America's secret Bosnia agenda. The European, November 25. How the CIA helps Bosnia fight back. Generally, ladies and gentlemen, when different national groups are living in a society where there's some measure of hope, security, and prosperity, they tend to get along. There may be ruffles and differences and turf scuffles and the like, but there's a lot of intermingling. There's even a lot of intermarriage, as was going on in Yugoslavia. And even in Croatia, where you could say the northwest part was overwhelmingly Croatian, the southeast part was Serbian. Even there were lots of Croatians living in the south, lots of Serbians in the north. Bosnia-Herzegovina was totally intermingled. That idea of partitioning Bosnia into these three parts was a totally artificial thing imposed. If you look, Michel Colon has a map of the ethnic distributions in Bosnia. Totally, I mean, they forcibly extract people block by block. They were so intermingled. When things are going okay, when things start going bad, when you've got sanctions, when you've got the loss of trade credits, when you've got 70% unemployment, when things are beginning to unravel and get desperate, that's when people begin to want to jump ship. And when you've got a U.S. national security state backing the most divisive, militant, fascistic national elements, with fascist organizations arising in Yugoslavia that hadn't been seen in 45 years, armed with guns and money and organization and hired thugs and operating with a blatant assurance that they had the whole might of the U.S. to their backs. That's when the divisions come. And you got a U.S. government that is actually pushing for civil war. And that economic decline and all that activated it. And what was the outcome? The outcome is that in Croatia, you now have the Republic of Croatia with President Tuđman, a Nazi sympathizer, who wrote a book saying the Holocaust wasn't all that bad and most of it never really happened. Tuđman, whose flag is the Czech Ustasi flag, which was the Nazi collaborators in World War II, whose army salutes with a straight-arm Nazi salute today. Tuđman, who suppressed the more liberal Croatian groups that wanted conciliatory policies with the Serbs. Tuđman, who presided over the forced evacuation of 600,000 Serbs from Croatia between 91 and 95. I don't see the media or the White House giving much indignant play to that one. Tuđman, who lives in obscene wealth along with his cronies, while the people of Croatia now wallow in economic misery. In Croatia, it's 5 years in prison if you criticize the president. But I don't hear Clinton talking about the need to bomb Croatia back into democracy. Then there's Bosnia, where the U.S. has supported the Muslim fundamentalist Izetbegovic. Izetbegovic, who was with the Waffen-SA when he was younger in World War II. A Nazi, not a collaborator, not a sympathizer, but an active Nazi. And who today now is the president of Bosnia. And hailed as a democratic leader who wants to establish a religious Islamic republic in Bosnia, who suppressed more liberal Muslim leaders. Bosnia is now under IMF and NATO regency. It's not permitted to mobilize and develop its own internal resources. It's not allowed to extend credit or self-finance through an independent monetary system. Its state-owned assets, including energy, water, telecommunications, media, and transportation, are all being sold off to private corporate investors at garage sale prices. And the Serbian part of Bosnia, which just last year democratically elected a president who was against the free market reforms, was removed forcibly by NATO troops because he was thought to be a hardliner, is the code word used there. NATO is in violation of its own charter, which says that it can take military action only against aggression that's been committed against one of its members. Yugoslavia has attacked no NATO member. What gives these U.S. leaders the right to intervene? What gives them the right? I hear my fellow Americans, some of my progressive friends sounding like little Colonel Blimps, little imperialists. Well, we've got to do something. We got to do something? Really? And the African nations? What if four or five African nations formed an alliance and decided that they didn't like 300 years of slavery for their people and lynch mob, Jim Crow segregation, another 100 years of that, and police brutality now? What if they decided to invade the U.S.? What if they had the power and the technology to do that and say, we don't like the way you've been treating the African minority in the U.S.? Well, we wouldn't think that that would be the normal course and they had an innate right, but there's this arrogance of power here that we, says the little fly on the chariot wheel, we are kicking up such a great dust. We, you're getting puffed up. That's got to stop this talking we. It's they that are doing it. We are against it. U.S. leaders have actually abandoned any kind of traditional diplomacy. You know, traditional diplomacy is a process of give and take. In traditional diplomacy, you have a proposal, a counter-proposal. You may pull back your ambassador to show your negotiators, to show your displeased that it's not working. You come back, you bluster, you bluff, you harangue, you make a new set of proposals, you bring in more mediation, you reach maybe even for your sword, but you never pull it from the scabbard. You come away finally with a solution which might leave both sides satisfied, one side perhaps more dissatisfied than the other, but never to the point of being forced to war. That's what traditional diplomacy was about. It was this way of trying to stop conflicts short of war. U.S. diplomacy is something else. U.S. diplomacy makes traditional diplomacy really look good. The goal, as it was done in Vietnam, as it was done against Nicaragua, as it was done against Iraq, as it's done against Yugoslavia, the method is to issue a set of demands. The demands are treated as non-negotiable. This is what you're going to have to do. Although to the American people and in the media, they're called accords. They're called agreements, as the Rambouillet agreements. Those weren't agreements. Those were ultimatums. And by the way, Milosevic accepted every one of the Rambouillet agreements except one. The one which said that foreign troops could come in and occupy all of Kosovo, and then there was a hidden subsection which not many people knew about, which said, and they would have the right to move into any part of Yugoslavia anywhere else at any time at their own discretion. It was a total surrender to a foreign occupation, and this was the unacceptable thing. The other side's resistance or even hesitancy in accepting these U.S. offers and proposals and agreements and accords, the other side's hesitancy is treated as an unwillingness to negotiate in good faith. It's announced that U.S. leaders are running out of patience. It's announced that the other side is stonewalling and snubbing these offers that we're making. And so U.S. leaders finally have no other recourse, having shown almost a Christ-like patience. They now have nothing left that they can do but bomb this other country and start killing large numbers of its men, women, and children. And as Bill Clinton says, you can blame all those deaths on Milosevic. That's right. He's the cause of it all. If he did exactly what we said when he was supposed to, this wouldn't have happened. And the side that resists and is hesitant is labeled as war criminals. Let me just read to you a statement that I got on the internet from a woman who is a member of the Greens Party in Belgrade. This is what she writes about the bombing. Now, this is already a month old. It's gotten much worse. Serbia is one of the greatest sources of underground waters in Europe, and the contamination from U.S. explosives and depleted uranium will be felt in the whole surrounding area all the way to the Black Sea. NATO is bombing factories. The workers in the greater part of our great industrial complexes have decided to make a living wall around their working places. They're doing this not only to defend their country, but because they have become so impoverished by the years of sanctions that the destruction of factories would mean condemnation to a poverty equal to death. In other words, these workers are trying to defend the only thing they have left, which is their social capital, the factories. NATO chooses extremely dangerous targets. And then she goes on about nuclear reactors, nuclear waste storage places that have been getting close to being hit, petrochemical factories where the fumes are escaping, artificial fertilizers. The municipality of Bodich has also been hit with the great complex for the production of chloride, which is using Bhopal technology. You remember what happened in Bhopal, 4,000 people died horrible deaths, respiration in Bhopal, India, from that industrial accident. It's not necessary for me to explain what the blowing up of one of such factories represents. Not only Belgrade, which is situated 10 kilometers distance, would be endangered, but the rest of Europe too. On the second day in the Belgrade suburbs, a factory for the chemical production and a rocket fuel storage was hit, causing intoxication of the entire surrounding area. Four national parks were hit, all members of the International Association of the National Reservations. You have to realize that Yugoslavia is among 13 of the world's richest biodiversity countries. And then she goes on to talk about the different cultural places. It has one of the richest film archives in the world that's been destroyed. Medieval Orthodox churches, monasteries, which are centuries old, and candidates for UNESCO heritage lists have been hit, and so forth and so on. And then she goes on to describe the terrible effect on children, elderly people, and all. Besides the actual killings, a lot of people are dying because they're simply the normal patterns of life, and life support systems are being destroyed. When you hit, you might see it in the paper, NATO is boasting that they're hitting the electricity systems in Yugoslavia. When you hit electricity, you are committing an act of chemical warfare, because the electricity systems are the only way you get water in any modern developed society. You need electricity to get water to you. If you don't have water, people need water to live. They need it to drink, they need it for cooking, they need it for cleaning themselves, they need it for waste disposal. With the warm weather coming up, and you wouldn't believe it here in Seattle, but with the warm weather coming up, there will be typhoid and typhus and this kind of stuff will break out. That's what's happening in Iraq. That's why people were dying there. You see, there's two kinds of bombings that are going on. There's a saturation bombing or carpet bombing. World War II, we used to call it saturation bombing. Carpet bombing was just killing people, but there is surgical strikes also. They are targeting these things. They're targeting, they've learned in Iraq, they learned it very well, that you can destroy the life support systems of the society. And when you do that, you make war, total war, upon the population. And that is what is happening. She goes on to say, I am deeply convinced that I am speaking in the name of all the citizens of Yugoslavia when I say that we have the capabilities and the political will to find a solution for the Kosovo problem. If we are allowed to seek the solution together with the Albanians, and if we take into consideration the fact that all of us have the right to participate in this solution. All one-sidedness and media manipulation are part of the mechanism bringing suffering, destruction, and death. By the way, there's 100,000 Albanians living in Belgrade. In Belgrade themselves, they have their own stores in Albania and all that sort of thing. And they're getting hit too. I want to read one other thing. This was written by Tom Watson. Anybody know who Tom Watson was? 100 years ago he wrote this, in 1898. Tom Watson was an American populist. He was governor of Georgia and U.S. senator, elected on the populist ticket to fight the Democratic and Republican monopoly of that day. And what was happening was William McKinley was very craftily drawing the American people into the Spanish-American War. McKinley said, we've got to go in, and the newspapers all said, we've got to go in to rescue the Cubans against whom the Spaniards are committing some of the worst horrible atrocities that you can imagine. And by the way, the Spaniards were no angels in Cuba. But most of those atrocity stories were coming out of the febrile, fertile imaginations of Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst and put into the penny press, and also coming out of U.S. Congress, too. And by the way, that's the same thing I'm saying here about Yugoslavia. To say that these atrocities are contrivances, for the most part, and propaganda, is not to say that Milosevic and the Serbs are blameless and that they're angels. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that we have to even be fans of any one side. Regardless of what you think of those people, certainly you can see that this bombing is a horrible thing. Now, Watson understood that this war was not in the interests of the American people. And he wrote this way, who gets the benefit of the war? the Spanish-American War he's talking about. The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads. National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. Munition makers will profit by this war. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end up by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If they were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless trouble, complications, expense? Republics cannot go into the conquering business and remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. And that's what you got. When you have a president, when you have a president who's in violation of the NATO Charter, who's in violation of the UN Charter, who's in violation of the War Powers Act, and who's in violation of the U.S. Constitution, where the founders of the Constitution said that you cannot leave this decision of war to only one man, and if you leave it to the president, you no longer have a president, you no longer have a republic, you have an emperor, you have a king. If he can commit a whole nation to war and killing just by his own personal judgment, that's not a democracy. And they said there's got to be a debate, and there's got to be accountability. You trust your president? You mean the way trust, meaning you give a certain, your destiny, a portion of your destiny to someone unquestioningly, as you might to very close loved ones or close relatives? And even then, check them out once in a while, right? Now, democracy isn't about faith. It isn't about trust. It's about distrust. It's about accountability. It's about challenge. It's about debate. It's about exposure. It's about people becoming the active agents of their own lives, wanting to know what's going on. I don't have to trust you. I don't want to trust you. I want to see what's going on. Whose interests do you really represent, my friends? And we hear people say, including some of our progressive friends, our liberal friends, yes, I know, the bombings don't work. Oh, I'm not supporting those bombings. The bombings are stupid, I know. But well, we've got to do something. Well, the bombings aren't stupid, they're profoundly immoral. The Serbian army, which is expelling people, by the way, many of those people are fleeing the bombings. If you read those accounts closely, you find a lot of these people saying, we're fleeing the bombings. 50,000 Serbs have fled from Kosovo in the last 3 months. Are the Serbs ethnically cleansing themselves? The bombings do work. The bombings are working. They know what they're doing. Just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean they don't know what they're doing. Of course they know what they're doing. The bombings are achieving what they're supposed to, which is to destroy Yugoslavia, to turn it into a deindustrialized, beggar-poor nation of cheap labor, completely defensive to the interests of capital investors. This is a batterer's policy. The batterer is not irrational. The batterer uses violence against his helpless spouse. He uses just a certain amount of level to get a certain response and batters that person down and batters the person down. And that's what this is. It's a battering policy to destroy and smash them down, but smash them and splinter them so badly that they will never rise again and never come back again, even as a viable bourgeois nation, let alone socialist. The old arguments we hear with regard to Vietnam are coming back. Well, we can't just pull out. Oh, yes, we can. We can. We can do it with two words. You can pull out with just two words, it's called ceasefire, and then another two words, NATO disband. And yes, we, the real we really do have to do something. Call the White House, call your Congress people, your media, talk back, demonstrate, organize, agitate, educate yourself and others, let them know how you feel. They want to know what the general public is thinking. They never stop thinking about you. When you say, oh, they don't care what we're thinking. Oh, no, they always, always focus on you because they know they're standing on your shoulders. And if this great mass began to shrug and rumble and all that sort of thing, it gets very wobbly up there. So against the lies... against the lies and the homicidal violence of this national security aberration, the thin, frail voice of reason and democracy can become a mighty chorus and a strong resistance. I have seen it happen before, and we can make it happen again. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.